Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In an era of acute political polarization, it is tempting to think of people in America and around the world as sequestered into political camps, talking over each other and rarely achieving a meeting of the minds that can lead to cooperation and progress. But separating and isolating ourselves from each other attenuates or destroys any chance we might have to grow together from the collective wisdom that we can all help cultivate. My guest today is a renowned data scientist whose new book argues that societies cannot move forward until we trade the stories that form what we know about the world with each other. And he argues that advances in technology can help us craft civic structures and institutions that further human rights and build strong, open communities. Alex Pentland directs the Connection Science and Human Dynamics Lab at MIT. He has advised the UN Secretary General's office. He's a regular at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He serves on advisory boards of major corporations, and as an entrepreneur, he has founded more than a dozen companies himself. An expert on AI, Professor Pentland's new book is a hopeful treatise on how AI can help and not harm the human condition. It's called Shared Wisdom: Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. Professor Alex Pentland and I spoke last week. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. Alex Pentland joined me from Palo Alto, California, on Zoom. And Professor, I understand folks call you Sandy, so I'm going to welcome you to the show as Sandy. Nice to have you.
Great. Yep, thanks. Yeah, my father had the same name of Alex, so I had to get something else, and Sandy's the diminutive, so there you are.
There you go. Okay, so you talk right in the preface of the book about the need to renovate and reimagine societies to an extent not seen since the Enlightenment. How do we need to renovate and reimagine our societies, given the current moment with things like AI, et cetera?
Well, you know, we live in an age where things don't seem to work. The government doesn't seem to work. International relations don't seem to work. All sorts of things just seem broken. And I think that the fundamental thing is that a lot of our institutions are built in the late 1700s. And they were pretty good for the late 1700s, but, you know, they didn't have instant communications. The population was a small fraction of what it is today, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to sort of renovate ourselves and figure out how to talk to each other, as you were saying. And if you look back in history, you see that one of the places where we were able to do that was the Enlightenment, the sort of end of the 1500s, beginning of the 1600s, people began to really change the way culture worked, how society worked. You know, after that sort of onslaught of ideas and conversation, kings were no longer in power, and, you know, religion got moved around in the pantheon of power, and we probably need something like that again today. So the question is how did we pull off this Enlightenment thing, and can we do it again? And I think the interesting observation, which is backed by a lot of history, is that in the Enlightenment, what happened is there were the ability to mail letters back and forth, but it wasn't available to people in general. It was just for the royalty. And they opened up the postal system. Now that sounds like, well, so yeah, great. But you got people like Leibniz and other sort of philosophers suddenly writing letters to each other because they could communicate for the first time. And, you know, take somebody like Leibniz, who is a famous sort of physicist, natural scientist person. He would write three letters a day for every day in his life. And these are not like little half-page letters. These are 15-page treatises. And what happened is there got to be this discussion among people who were interested in the way the world worked and the way we sort of helped run ourselves, the way the world was evolving, that turned into what they call societies of letters, like the Royal Society. And the people that participated were called men of letters. They were all men. Okay, well, you know, we can do a little better there. And the question is, how can we actually promote that sort of constructive discussion today? And, you know, hey, look, we have internet, we have social media, etc., but they haven't turned out real well. You know, social media is sort of a cesspit. There's all these like super loud voices with 10 million followers, and they're all incentivized to be crazy, because if you're shocking, you get more ad revenue. And so, you know, it just doesn't work. And so the things that I and my students and compatriots sort of did is said, well, let's step back and ask if we can build something that's suited to people and not just to making money or just, you know, trading bits of information back and forth. And what that requires is that everybody have a more or less equal voice, that you be able to see the range of opinions, that it's a sort of evolving thing, it's not an authoritarian type of a thing. And we've built systems to help people do this type of thing as a science project. And by that, I mean, we're not committed to this is the answer. We're going to learn from actually using it. So there's a website called deliberation.io. It's all open. All the source code is there, and the experiments are there. And Washington, D.C., the city, not the federal government, is using it to help them understand how they can better serve citizens. And what it does really is it is designed so that none of those loud voices are allowed. You can't have followers. You can't be shocking and attract a lot of attention. All the comments are equal. Everybody has an equal voice. Everybody is able to see a graphic of what all the opinions are very quickly so that you can begin to sort of modify your opinion. And what you find is that people are actually really interested in talking to each other. And then there's a few crazy people on the far sides, right? On the far left and on the far right. And when you see that graphically, you realize that, hey, most of us actually have what I think is a sensible opinion. And then there's a few people who are trying to rabble rouse. And what that does is that brings people together in a way that's really surprising. And we have data and experiments and things like that about that.
So is the issue then, do you think, are the reasons that current social media doesn't work, and I couldn't agree with you more about that, is it regulatory? Is it because it's not organized the right way? Or is it a product of human instinct and behavior? I remember when the internet first became part of our lives, I did a story about how the two categories of internet searches that were the leading two categories were pornography and religion. And I'm not wasn't quite sure what to make of those of that little data
that
point.
Combination,
you know,
yeah.
But is it that, you know, human beings, the loudest voices, you know, get attention and get followers and get clicks. Clearly there is a financial motive there on behalf of the companies who own these platforms. But I wonder if it's also, we know more, you write about this in the book, that we know more about human behavior now than we did even in the Enlightenment. What do we know about human behavior and its, contribution to the mess that is current social media?
Well, it's not just one problem. There is the loud voices problem, and there's also the alarm, you know, worry, sort of things. So in the Enlightenment and sort of the way actually we're all taught in schools, we're taught that we're individuals, that we're trying to be logical and so forth. But that's actually not what people do. People look at the other people around them, that's called culture, and they try and draw and behave according to the culture. They try to learn from other people, and that's a wonderful thing, actually. That's how culture evolves. But we also are alerted by things that are dangerous. So things that struck our emotions are things that we pay inordinate attention to. And we have a limited amount of attention, so we don't hear the voices of everybody else. when that happens. And the way the social media are constructed are that it makes those loud voices very, very prominent. And so it drowns out the conversation. And what we're trying to do is make a type of social media that keeps people focused on the problem, doesn't allow loud voices, gets you to see really the face of the crowd and what everybody thinks. And it surprises most people, but even on contentious issues, things like gun control or abortion, most people are pretty much in agreement, except for the people on the far ends. And they tend to dominate all of the conversation because of economic incentives, because they're going, sky is falling, and we all go, oh, pay attention. So we've engineered things to use sort of defects or alerting things in our nature as opposed to have real deliberations.
And what role does AI play in that structure?
So we, in this deliberation IO thing that we built, it does two things. One is it sort of stops people and say, do you really want to swear like that or say crazy stuff? So it keeps people a little bit civic, right? And it turns out that people are okay with that as long as they get to say what they want to say. And then the other thing it does is the AI provides sort of a running summary of what people are saying. It doesn't add any content. It just says, I hear some of this, and I hear other people saying this. And what that does is that reminds you that there's a lot of people there and a lot of different voices, and you need to pay attention to all of them without adding content or opinions that are from the AI. It's like a good mediator. And it turns out that this works pretty well. Another sort of thing that goes with that, though, is that, for instance, in this Washington, D.C. Town hall that we ran, what people wanted was a yet another type of AI. So that first type of AI that I just talked about is about trying to be a mediator, a bringing together platform for people to discuss. The thing that people said they wanted most from the city was they wanted to have an AI that would help them deal with all the complexity of the city. So a personal AI, something that you owned that would defend you, an AI defender or AI buddy. So those are two types of AIs that fit very much within sort of human nature without appealing to the alerting or danger responses and without allowing sort of dominance by complexity, by funny sort of arguments and threats.
Alex Pentland, the book is called Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take calls or online comments today. So, Sandy, you write that a blind spot within Western society is that we focus too much on the individual and not enough on the surrounding community. But, of course, the difficulty of focus on the community is that the community is often fractured. I mean, look at the American electorate. It's kind of fractured right down the middle. How should we readjust our focus to the community? And won't that take, a buy-in to the value of community?
Well, so if you think about the digital platforms that are out there, there's an assumption that everybody is part of one big community. And you just said it yourself. You said everybody in the whole country. But actually, I don't live and you don't live everywhere in the country. You live in a specific place. And if the trash doesn't get picked up in your neighborhood, it's your neighborhood, not my neighborhood. You may want it to be done differently than I do. You may want your kids to be educated differently than I do. So having these things that are uniform really ignores the fact that different places are different and the people that live there have slightly different desires. Yet everything is engineered and our politics are engineered to think only about uniform and global. And if you look at sort of what that's doing, that's saying we're going to tune all of our systems for the average person without any friends, family, or local community. That's just them as a bare, naked person, right? Staring down the face of the government or whatever, or the big companies. And anybody who isn't average is out of luck because it's tuned for the average person. Different communities are different. Some communities are poor, some are rich, more educated, less educated, more blue collar, more white collar. All of those need different sorts of facilities, and they need to learn from each other. So we've ignored that whole level of culture, the local culture. And as a consequence, you can't talk to your neighbors. If you look at how much neighbors talk to each other, it's very, very little, and it's much less than when the social media and digital revolution happened. This is the famous book, Bowling Alone. All of our civic organizations have atrophied because all of our communication tools ignore that level of organization.
And when we come back from a quick break, we're going to talk about what happens when we talk to each other, and that is sharing stories. Alex Pentland is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. We'll have more with Professor Pentland on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's midday on music. Two acclaimed music journalists will join me to talk about their latest books. Al Shipley's Tough Breaks tells the story of Baltimore club music, whose influence ranges far beyond Charm City. Jeffrey Himes has written an encyclopedic survey of all of the albums of the great Willie Nelson, chronicling a career that spans more than 60 years. So that's on the way tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Alex Pentland. He's a professor of computer science at MIT, a Stanford HAI fellow, and an advisor to governments and industry. We're talking about his new book, Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. So, Sandy Pentland, you talk about the importance of stories. You mentioned the Enlightenment and when people started sharing ideas from letters, but you go even further back to people sitting around, the hunter-gatherer types sitting around the campfire at the end of the night, talking with each other and trading stories. And you talk about calling these this information trade story to emphasize the uncertainty of our knowledge and the need to be continually skeptical of facts and strategies and theories. So facts, strategies, and theories are important, but stories perhaps even more important. And how do you see them parsing out differently?
Well, so in modern day parlance and science, we talk about facts and but actually, you know, science is always a continuing guessing game. You take the evidence, you try and say, here's a hypothesis that fits it, and people say, yeah, maybe that's true, but then 30 years later something comes along that says, oh, it's not quite right, it's a little bit different this way. So facts are really slippery things. What people end up remembering is the story about why things are a particular way or how they work. And this is a very ancient and very intrinsic part of our nature. So it used to be said that people were unique because we had words. It turns out that things like whales and apes have words too, and they even have like simple little grammars. But what they don't do is they don't tell stories to each other. And stories are not just like entertainment and fun. They're, oh, I did this and then that happened. It could be like I ate the blue grapes and then I got sick. What that tells somebody is don't eat the blue grapes, right? And that seems to have actually been the invention, that trading of if this, then that, which are really a sort of a simple type of scientific theory, right? That seems to be the thing that differentiates us from our ancestors and from other animals. And if you study hunter-gatherer groups, there's still a few in the world, what you find is that the conversations they have that are like that, trading those sort of stories, determine what they're going to do the next day. But it's much more than that, because they also share older stories, stories about how they got here, who they are. And in fact, if you go to Western Australia, where a lot of the stories are pretty much the same as they were before white folks showed up, you can date the stories, and you see stories that are over 7,000 years old. And you date them by saying, oh, this is a story about an asteroid strike, and we can date the asteroid strike. So that stories, the stories you tell about yourself and where you're going, and even very fine recent stories about like where there's food today, or don't go over there, it's dangerous. That's our culture. That's the thing we call culture. It's our wisdom. It's the thing we share with each other. And that's how we survive. That's really the basic element for human groups to adapt to their environment and thrive. And we are taught not that, but that it's just these sort of facts and that they're eternal and so forth. So we need to focus much more on the fact that we don't know all the answers, that the world continually changes and the answers will change as the world changes, and focus instead on trading knowledge with each other, trading stories, and building a consensus, which I call the sort of shared wisdom about what works, what doesn't work, and what we should begin to do together. Because you need to have that sort of shared understanding before a community can decide to act collectively. And that's the key to being able to survive all the challenges that we have today. We have to sort of get together, talk, and figure out how to do it.
The book is, just remind folks that the name of the book is Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. And my guest is Professor Alex Pentland from MIT and various other places. So it's interesting, Sandy, that you mention the sort of logistics that need to be traded and shared. You know, don't go over there because it's dangerous. Don't eat the blue grapes. And then the historic stories about what happened back in the day. I wonder where the stories that deal with values fit into this equation. Years ago, I interviewed E.L. Doctorow, who had just published a compendium of stories, not written by him, but analyzed by him. So it was stories of everybody from Groucho Marx to Henry Miller to Genesis. And he, as an author himself, it's like a composer dissecting a piece of music. It's different than when a musicologist does it, because the composers are used to looking at things from the inside out. I was fascinated by this book, and he says that stories propose life as something of moral consequence. And that's why stories are so important. And that was the whole premise of his book. Here are the stories that he thinks are very important, and then he analyzed them all. But they propose life as something of moral consequence. So when it comes to values, when it comes to creating consensus about values, how do we get to that point where we can, in fact, agree on pretty basic stuff?
Well, I'm as a scientist, I try to think very carefully about words like moral values. I tend to look at those as being, those are the things we need to do to live and flourish. Okay? So that takes a little bit of sort of the religious tone out of it. It takes a little bit of the do this or we'll punish you tone out of it. It's saying why you should pay attention to this moral value. It's because it'll help us get along and thrive. And the way we come up with those, because we invent those I don't believe are just given and out there, and they change over time depending on the situation that we're in. If we're in a very desperate situation, different things are okay to do than if you're in a very sort of rich, comfortable type of a thing. The way you come up with those values is through trading stories about what happens if you violate those and why you want to pay attention. So these sort of stories about who we are, the Homeric stories, the stories of religion, of saints, of things like that, are the things that are teaching us what are the correct ways to behave in order to flourish. But these are just stories, right? We don't know that they're true, and they will change over time. If you look at the stories, for instance, the religious stories, what stories are told most commonly, it's different now than it was 500 years ago. It's not that we're different, but the world is very different, and what we need to think about doing is very different today than 500 years ago. So the stories that are most salient, most relevant, change over time.
One of the things that's different about us is the way we congregate and live, which is to say more of us live in cities now than back in the hunter-gatherer days or even Enlightenment times and through much of the 18th and even 19th century, which was a more rural existence for most people, an agricultural economy in most places. Now we're in cities, and you write about the fact that cities are cramped, they're expensive, they're dirty, they're dangerous, but there's also improved access to opportunity, which is why more and more people are moving to cities and why they're becoming larger and larger. And when we talk about political polarity in this moment, historically, here in the United States, a big divide is the metropolitan people versus the people who live in rural areas. I mean, politically, that's where a big divide stands. So when it comes to the importance of, you know, how we congregate, how we live in these cities, what's the role then of AI in that? What's the role of community in a city as opposed to much smaller communities, say in a, you know, farm town in Iowa somewhere?
Well, cities have always been cramped and difficult to live in, but the storytelling, the trading between different cultures is much greater, so that creates the opportunity. So today, if you look at cities with sort of fine-grained data and you look at what stories are being told to who, you find that the communities, and I mean physical neighborhoods here, that interact with lots of other neighborhoods are the neighborhoods that are getting richer, almost always. If you find a neighborhood that only talks to other neighborhoods that are like itself and is otherwise sort of a ghetto, that's a place that has higher crime, the kids don't grow up successful, and so forth. And it's really striking and really strong, but yet we don't design our cities for that sort of mixing. Perhaps the best thing we've come up with in cities is coffee houses. It turns out that if you have things like coffee houses along a street, then that brings different neighbors together in a way that's always been very, very conducive to change, which is why some of the kings and queens of the past didn't like coffee. But here's a thing that's really interesting, is that if you take a kid that's growing up in a deprived neighborhood, a neighborhood that doesn't get to see how other people live, and that kid is exposed to even one person in their neighborhood who has become successful, has adopted some new way of living and thrives, then that exposure almost doubles the chance that the kid will grow up to be successful themselves. And we're talking about kids less than 5 years old. It's like these patterns of behavior, these stories of how you do things are imprinted on kids very, very young, and it has enormous effect on them as they get older. So we need to begin to design cities to promote that sort of mixing in a different sort of way. I can give you a concrete example. In Boston, they wanted to have a sort of free WeWork type places, places to go and do individual level sort of work in the libraries that were being underused. And of course, the obvious thing to do is just set it up and open it. But what you want to do is pick libraries that are between rich communities and poor communities so that you can get more mixing between the different populations. And so same thing with transportation lines. You don't want transportation lines that go from one poor neighborhood to the next. You want them to go through lots of different types of neighborhoods so that you can get more mixing. And the tools to do that are a type of AI, a type of AI that looks at these patterns and tries to imagine what would happen if we put the streets or the libraries or the, in different places.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, back to values, transportation is a great example. There's all sorts of examples of people making sure that public transportation doesn't allow people from poor neighborhoods to come to the wealthier neighborhoods, you know, because they are not at NIMBYs, you know, not in my backyard. And again,
but it turns out that that's actually sort of the best way to prevent crime, not to keep them out, but to mix them.
Well, you know, that's a tough sell to a lot of folks. I don't disagree. I don't disagree by any means. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. And the other point that you make about cities is that because they're so populous, because there's so many people, that power is delegated. That individuals have less power in large groups, and they delegate their power to a small number of people, and it produces, as you write about, produces a hierarchy where centralized authorities tell citizens how to behave. Again, it's kind of almost an imposition of values. You write about democracy in this book and how communities can thrive and have more vigorous democracies if the communication is better. But how do you reckon those two things where there's a number of people who need to be represented? Can they all represent themselves? Doesn't that get out of hand at some point?
See, this is sort of the classic thing that's different between, say, 1800 and today. In the year 1800, you had to have a hierarchy because of the communication. Okay, so there had to be this elite in charge of things. But today, you know, we can talk to anybody. We can collect statistics and votes from any group of people. And in fact, what you can have is you can have much better coordination between local groups to make global solutions. So imagine that social services are administered locally, not by some big bureaucracy that's in the capital. And you say, well, how can that happen? Well, there are examples of that happening. For instance, in the United States, you might say, well, things like commerce and ownership and certain sorts of things like adoption and so forth, they're all sort of consistent between the states. That makes you think that maybe the federal guys did it, but it's not. It's a volunteer organization called the Uniform Law Commission that gets together and says, hey, guys from this other state, you know, our laws and your laws don't quite work well together, and that really hurts both of us. Why don't we make our laws sort of aligned and interoperable where we can do the things that are specific and helpful to our context? Maybe we're a mountain state, and you can do the stuff that's specific for your state. Maybe you're a plains state. But that when people move from one place to another or goods move, it's consistent. That accounts for about 10% of all the law in the United States. It's this stuff that is really grassroots. And today, given the sort of tools that you have about being able to, you know, characterize things, to see things, to communicate things, it's very possible to administer things grassroots up as opposed to top down. And we have examples that work. And I think we ought to pay a lot more attention to that because different neighborhoods have different needs.
The book is Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. The author is my guest, Professor Alex Pentland. Alex Pentland is with us until the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Alex Pentland. He's a professor at MIT and a consultant with businesses and governments around the world. His new book is called Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. Our conversation was pre-recorded last week, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. So, Sandy Pentland, you have a chapter in the book about the unintended side effects, and you ask how we can leverage digital media and AI to go from the current situation to a more agile and innovative set of institutions that better serve us. There are some things that homogenize the culture, television, things like that, media in general, and other things that can serve to fracture it. When it comes to, you mentioned this projects that you and your students have started, I guess, is it just in Washington, D.C., the Innovation I.O.?
We do it at different places, the Deliberation I.O.
Deliberation.
So Washington, D.C. is the most iconic place that we do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Is it going to take that kind of, speaking of grassroots, as we were talking about before the break, that kind of, come up from the bottom institutions, new formats, new platforms coming up, or is there a way of taking the current social media structures and reshaping them in a way that they act more productively and positively?
Well, the sort of things that we're doing are trying to establish like best practices and connect that to harms, so that if you engineer your platform this way, suddenly you're at risk of lawsuits for these sorts of harms, because we're now having the connections there. But let me just sort of step back one piece and sort of say, what is it that we'd really like to see? We'd like to see things that facilitate people talking to each other, right? And when we talked to the people of Washington, D.C., what they suggested is that they would like to have a little personal AI, a tool, something that would help them deal with the complexity of life, and in particular with the complexity of government. So this is something that is the sort of next generation of AI that's happening right now, where it's called AI agents. And of course, companies are thinking about an agent to help people buy stuff from them. But we have a project with a number of companies and with Consumer Reports and other sort of pro-social organizations to build agents that help individuals deal with all the AIs and organizations around them, something sort of like an AI defender. And I think that's really interesting. And in fact, it's become something of a conversation piece in Silicon Valley. For instance, the biggest venture capital firm, Andreessen Horowitz, points out that if everybody has their own sort of agents for this, right, that in fact a lot of the advertising on the net will go away, because you'll say, look, I want to buy a blender. The agent will go like search the statistics and the facts about the blenders and say, how about this one? And you don't spend your time being persuaded by the smiling person on the web page or little jingles or things like that. And so it's expected that there's going to be big, big changes in these platforms, because they're mostly driven by that sort of junky advertising. That's the thing that makes clicks so important, because that's how they make money. And the expectation is it's going to go away. Not entirely, but largely. And so I think the way to think about this, the thing that you can do, is actually sort of lean into this notion of AI agents that help you shop, help you do things, because that gets rid of the need for advertising. And what we're doing now is we're trying to, A, do more of that, but also make it a legal requirement. Because if you have things that are AIs or programs that are helping you shop or find a healthcare facility or something like that, then there's legal requirements about that. And we're trying to make that very connected to the AI, so that if somebody builds a tool, an AI agent, that doesn't satisfy the legal requirements, they get nailed. And so we hope to sort of bring the industry up to something where they're building agents that are helpful to you, and not just agents that scream at you with ads and try and sell you junk.
So if advertising goes away, what happens to the corollary to advertising, which is very, very profitable for these social media platforms that we know now, and that's data ownership? People are selling data about the ads that people are watching, because it's an indice of what they're interested in at any given moment. I mean, if you go online and you click on a pair of shoes in an ad, then all of a sudden you're going to get a million different shoe ads, just because just that inclination to want to buy a pair of shoes is going to be valuable to somebody. How do we incorporate data ownership rights into the architecture of AI and social media platforms?
So you put your finger on what may be the most important part of this, is that when you have something that acts for you, it doesn't have to share data. It can say, I want a blender, but I'm not going to tell you who I am. I'm just going to, if I like your blender, I'll send you a credit card number, but I'm not going to tell you my age, my gender, where, any of those other sorts of things. And that's why people like Consumer Reports and some of the other NGOs that help us are doing this, is because it pulls back ownership of data to the person, because the agency for who does it is no longer in the company, it's with you. And so it's a sort of paradoxical thing, but these AI tools, when used in the service of an individual, dramatically increase the notions of privacy. And that's the real prize that we're working for, right? So great that you asked that question.
You also write about democracy and the process of building consensus and the problem that's huge, we all are aware of it, of misinformation and disinformation. And I'm dying to ask you this because you're a famous computational scientist. False information spreads more quickly than the truth. And as a journalist, this keeps me up at night. Why is that? What is so cool about falsity that it overwhelms, as George W. Bush used to say, truthiness?
Well, imagine you're a hunter-gatherer 200,000 years ago, and you heard a lion roar. That would get your adrenaline up for sure, okay? It's the same thing. We have specialized systems in our bodies to alert us to danger. So when you have something that is worrisome, really alerting, worrisome, you get all fired up about it, and you get very active, and you tell people, and that's why we weren't all eaten by lions. Another thing that happens is things like meme stocks and other sorts of fads. It's like if somebody says, oh, I bought this thing and it's gone up 100 times in value, and then everyone says, oh, really? Well, let's look at that, right? So we have that side of it too. There's a good side and then the danger side. And the big thing that people are able to do, and you may not believe it, but actually if you talk about these things, you'll calm down. I mean, just time and time again, when we do these sorts of experiments, when we deploy things in real situations, if you're able to just sort of talk about it a little bit, you come to a much more reasonable solution than the, the sky is falling sorts of reaction that is your immediate reaction. But you have to have social media that doesn't profit from those alerting responses. They've done some things that are pretty interesting in social media that are sort of halfway in between now. So some social media platforms like X and Facebook have community notes, which is a way to sort of say, call out bad information. It doesn't act quite as well as you might hope, because it takes a little while to really act.
Is AI monitoring that?
AI helps you identify things that are controversial. It can help you I mean, when you use search on Google, for instance, right, or Bing, that's an AI, right? It's helping you find other ideas. And so what AI can do is help make sure that you've seen the range of ideas about this piece of information and are able to have a better, more considered opinion about it. So you can build AIs like that. The question, of course, is this in the profit interest of the platforms? And I think that's why taking the power away from the platforms and moving it to yourself, right, through having your own sort of AI is a really interesting way to do things, because then you can talk to each other without the platform.
I'm just in our last minute here talking about shared wisdom. We also live in an age of what we in the media call the low information voter, people who are making decisions based on Lord knows what, or based on very limited information, or at least sources that are limited sources. How do we? What's the role of, you know, erudition and comprehension and understanding of the community to come to consensus and share wisdom that's in fact wise?
Well, I think the evidence is that if people are actually talking about their actual experiences, that they come to fairly good conclusions about what's working and what's not. And erudition is often, too often, just a way to sort of BS people. Some people are really good at it, some people are not. It doesn't change whether a system works or not. So I think that people have a lot more common sense, and the combination of people when they're talking about things has a lot more common sense than the pollsters and the news media give them credit for. It makes the news media and the pollsters feel good when they're smarter than the average person, but I don't know that I believe that.
All right, fair enough, and we're going to have to end it there. Alex Pentland, his latest book is Shared Wisdom, Cultural Evolution in the Age of AI. It's really been great meeting you and talking about this book, which I enjoyed thoroughly. Thanks so much.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Music. I'll speak with Al Shipley about his book, Tough Breaks, the story of Baltimore club music, and Jeffrey Himes, whose new book is Willie Nelson, All the Albums, the Stories Behind the Music. Fresh Air is up next after news at the top of the hour, so stick around for that. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.